Welcome to the podcast, Tis But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction about the Middle Ages. I'm your host, Professor Richard Abels. A month ago, Professor Larissa Cat Tracy joined me to talk about my favorite medieval romance, Chrétien de Troyes' late 12th century poem, Yvain the Knight with the Lion. As Cat pointed out in that episode, in that and other romances, Chrétien tended to extol marital love, not adulterous passion. The one exception is his Lancelot, the Knight of the Cart, which introduced into the Arthurian canon the figure of Lancelot and his adulterous love for Queen Guinevere. Adultery is at the heart of the two best-known stories from medieval romance, those of Lancelot and Guinevere and Tristan and Isolde. But did medieval courtly love poets actually approve of adultery as a form of what they called fond amour, fine loving? And how was adultery actually regarded and dealt with during the High and Late Middle Ages? I'm delighted to have back to discuss these issues an expert on the treatment of adultery in medieval literature, the incandescent Cat. Welcome back, Cat.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be back.
Great to have you. So, Ellen and I recently watched a really interesting and nicely done PBS documentary, Dante from Inferno to Paradise. And it struck me that we can enter the subject of medieval adultery through the gates of Dante's hell. Dante places adulterers in the second ring of hell, the place of punishment for the lustful. There the souls of the lustful are buffeted in a maelstrom of conflicting winds. All the punishments in Dante's hell accord to the principle of contra passo, that is, they are appropriate for that particular sin, just as these sinners were driven in life by unbridled desire, so in the afterlife they are driven helplessly in an eternal circle by these hurricane winds. Now, among those that Dante sees and encounters are two figures whom he personally knew, and he wants to speak with them. He recognizes the figures of Francesca and Paolo de Rimini. Dante's contemporary audience would have been well aware of their story. Francesca, daughter of Guido Vecchio de Polenta, was married for political reasons to Giovanni Malatesta, the eldest son of the Lord of Rimini, who was called Gian Ciotto, John the Lame, though probably not to his face, on account of a birth deformity. 10 years into the marriage, Gian Ciotto caught his handsome brother Paolo and his wife Francesca in flagrante, and he killed them both with a sword. Dante receives approval to speak with them, and they are released from the maelstrom long enough to answer his questions. Dante calls out, and this is in John Ciotti's translation, "Alas, how many sweet thoughts, how great desire brought them to this woeful pass. Then I turned to them again to speak and began, Francesca, your torments make me weep for grief and pity. But tell me, in the time of your sweet sighing, how and by what occasion did they grant you to know your uncertain desires?
The double grief of a lost bliss is to recall its happy hour and pain. Your guide and teacher knows the truth to this. But if there is indeed a soul in hell to ask of the beginning of our love, out of his pity I will weep and tell. On a day for dalliance, we read the rhyme of Lancelot, how love had mastered him. We were alone with innocence in dim time. Pause after pause, that high old story drew our eyes together while we blushed and paled. But it was one soft passage overthrew our caution in our hearts. For when we read how her fond smile was kissed by such a lover, he who is one with me alive and dead breathed on my lips the tremor of his kiss, that book, and he who wrote it, was a pander. That day we read no further."
Well, Dante makes it clear in the Purgatorio and the Paradiso that passionate love is not in itself a sin. His definition of lust, in fact, is Aristotelian, probably from Aquinas, and it's the subordination of reason to passion and desire. True love, such as the love that Dante had for Beatrice, Yeah, I know. I know.
He never actually spoke to.
Yeah, and who was married while he was married.
And who died fairly young. Yeah, 24 years. Ever knowing who he was.
24 years old, yeah.
Yes.
But the love that he had for Beatrice is in accord with reason and draws one toward God. Illicit passion subordinates reason and casts one into sin.
The idea of sexual lust and of the lustful for Dante particularly is complicated because, yes, he has them in hell, but he puts them in the second circle. Even people who should probably correctly be in much deeper circles, like Dido, she commits suicide. So she should rightly be in the circle, the seventh circle, with the forest of the suicides. But Dante sympathizes with her and sympathizes with those lovers who have either committed suicide or been murdered because of love, because he sees himself as one of their number. Of all of the sins of which he might possibly admit, Dante's would be love.
I agree. Dante claims that through Beatrice he has come to a higher understanding of spiritual love. But he's also aware of the afterlife that awaited him if he hadn't. And that afterlife would be burning in purgatory on the terrace of lust alongside the love poets he emulated and admired. And perhaps because the Dante of the Inferno is not yet the enlightened Dante of the Paradiso, he seems to have real sympathy for the suffering of Francesca, even though he knows that her adultery is a sin. And Francesca, for her part, doesn't seem to be all that penitent.
No.
She's sort of justifying what she felt with Paolo and what she did with Paolo.
Absolutely. And in fact, when Dante speaks to them, their eternal punishment is punishment, yes, because they're not in heaven. They don't get to see the face of God.
But they're together.
But they're together. And they are not only together, they are locked together in this maelstrom, in this whirlwind. And they are locked together for eternity. That love that, honestly, in real life, but more than just a moment, because they actually were together for years. They carried on their adultery for a number of years. And she and her husband had children. There were all questions of inheritance and dynastic issues. But Dante puts her husband further down in hell as one of those who commits violence against relatives.
He puts him
all the way down to the bottom of hell for having murdered the adulterous couple, but he shows the adulterous couple leniency.
The church's canon law made a point that killing an adulterous spouse remained the sin of murder. Thomas Aquinas deals explicitly with the question whether it is ever lawful to kill a wife if the husband catches her in the act of adultery. His answer is no. Aquinas acknowledges that civil law may treat the act, and I quote here, as though it were lawful by not inflicting on him the punishment for murder on account of the very great provocation which the husband receives by such a deed. But the church does not acquit him either of the debt of eternal punishment or of such punishment as may be awarded him by an ecclesiastical court. End quote. For Thomas, murder is murder. But it's interesting that he also acknowledges that secular courts may be more understanding of the provocation than ecclesiastical courts would have been.
Especially if it's against family. And that's why Dante places them much further in hell.
Francesca's answer to Dante's question brings us to the subject of today's episode, adulterous love in medieval romance, particularly in the tale of Lancelot and Guinevere. In Francesca's retelling of how her adulterous liaison with her brother-in-law began, she and Paolo were mutually seduced.
Yes.
Both of them are seduced. They're seduced by reading about Lancelot and Guinevere.
Whatever harm came from reading a book,
says
Evie in The Mummy, right before she resurrects the mummy.
And to make the point that medieval romance can act like a pander, leading unwary readers into the sin of lust, Dante also places Tristan in the whirlwind of the second circle of hell.
And Mark with the murderers.
Yes, but I can't help but think that if Paolo and Francesca had exercised a little bit of patience, read a little bit further into the story, they would have maybe had some second thoughts about this because it doesn't end up really well.
No, it doesn't. None of them do.
And Tristan doesn't end up well either.
He ends up with an axe in his head.
Yeah. His soul doesn't end. Nobody ends up well.
Yeah.
The story of Lancelot has always struck me as problematic. By the early 14th century, when Dante wrote the Inferno, Lancelot was portrayed as the greatest of King Arthur's knights and beloved of the king. Arthur, in the medieval romances that make up the matter of Britain, is presented as the exemplar of kingship and his court as the model of chivalry. And yet, Arthur in the Lancelot story is a cuckold.
Right, and he's a cuckold from his very first story, just not always with Lancelot.
So and that's interesting.
In the very first full-blown story of King Arthur, and we talked about this the last episode, in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, which is written in the middle of the 12th century, right at a time of civil conflict in England,
yes,
between Stephen and Matilda, it's not Lancelot who has an affair with Guinevere, because Lancelot doesn't exist. Lancelot is not in that story.
Cretien is waiting to create
him. He's just waiting. And this is middle of the 12th century. So you have this story of a warrior king who actually resembles Beowulf more than he resembles a chivalric knight. And his wife, Guinevere, is largely two-dimensional. And when his nephew, Mordred, usurps his throne because he's off heading towards Rome to sack Rome, as you do, and he leaves the throne in the care of Mordred. Mordred takes the crown, takes Guinevere. Guinevere's not willing. Guinevere resists. And in that first episode, that first account of Arthur, she refuses Mordred's advances.
Yes.
When that text is translated at the request of Eleanor of Aquitaine, about whom there were also many, many rumors of adultery, but that would be fair because Henry II, her husband, was engaging in adultery with pretty much everybody.
The fair Rosamond.
And she's one, yeah. Yes. Rosamond is one of many. But Eleanor herself faced rumors of adultery.
Yeah, with her uncle.
With her
which,
uncle?
Which seems to be a scurrilous rumor.
Is a scurrilous rumor, and it's highly unlikely.
Highly unlikely. This alleged incestuous adultery supposedly took place during the Second Crusade when King Louis VII and his then wife Eleanor were guests of Eleanor's uncle Raymond of Poitiers, Prince of Antioch. The story originates with the historian of Outremer, William of Tyre, who cast Raymond in the role of the vile seducer. It was subsequently widely alluded to, though rarely explicitly stated, by English chroniclers. What seems clear is that the royal couple were experiencing marital difficulties while at Antioch. John of Salisbury, who was well positioned to know what happened, reports that King Louis was disturbed by Raymond's close attention to his niece and their constant conversations. And when he told her that they were to leave for Jerusalem, Eleanor told him that she wished to remain behind with her uncle. When Louis insisted that she accompany him, Eleanor supposedly raised the issue of their consanguinity, which called into question the legitimacy of their marriage. And this was the issue that would later be used by mutual agreement to dissolve their union. I suspect that Raymond was not attempting to seduce his niece, but saw her as possible leverage to get from Louis what he desperately wanted from the king, which is military support for his campaign against Turkish-held Aleppo and Caesarea. I just add that it would have been truly brazen for Eleanor to have brought up the issue of consanguinity with her husband in the fourth degree if she was then engaged in sex with her uncle.
Right, as some kind of leverage to do that,
yes,
and get her to convince Louis to stop this nonsense. But, of course, with Eleanor, you also have the allegations or the rumors that she had an affair with Henry's father, Geoffrey of Anjou, which, again, is unlikely. And because she was a forthright, bold woman who was powerful in her own right, the rumors are not surprising.
No, they're not surprising.
That's the best way to essentially cripple a woman's aristocratic reputation, is accuse her of adultery, especially
yes,
if she's the mother of future kings. Because if you can cast doubt on those lines of succession, then you can make your own political inroads and manipulate the situation however you like. And so when Eleanor commissions Wass to translate Geoffrey of Monmouth,
yes,
In that text, we not only see the addition of chivalry and the round table to the Arthurian story, Guinevere becomes a little more complicit in Mordred's treachery, and that becomes more problematic. In 1191, when Lamon translates the text into Middle English, probably at the behest of Eleanor's son Richard, not only is Guinevere complicit, she is full on in favor of that adultery with Mordred. In fact, Arthur has a dream that he is sitting in his hall, and it's very much like the Mead Hall in Heorot and Beowulf, and he and Gawain are sitting in the rafters of this hall, and Mordred comes into the hall with an axe, and he starts hacking at the supports of the hall with an axe, but then Guinevere comes in, and she starts tearing the hall down with her bare hands, which in that dream tells Arthur that actually the greater danger isn't his nephew Mordred, it's his queen. And in that version of the Arthurian story, Guinevere is wholeheartedly 100% complicit in helping Mordred throw over Arthur, but also engaging in adultery. And I believe in that text, they have children. And so in 1191, when we're still dealing with the chronicles, the legendary histories, quote unquote, that are meant to be histories, there's no Lancelot. The main traitor is Mordred. And Guinevere becomes increasingly complicit in the treason that Mordred commits. And her treason is twofold, because it's not only helping Mordred take the throne, it's sharing his bed. Because when a queen commits adultery, that's a crime against the state. And thus, any queen who commits adultery is committing treason.
Well, it strikes me that Guinevere turns into sort of the medieval version of a hot wife in Maria France's Lanval.
Oh, yes. And when Chrétien de Troyes is creating his set of Arthurian romances, the only one of Marie de France's lays that actually overtly says it's Arthurian is Lanval. And in that text, Arthur is a questionable king to start with, because he's not giving Lanval the kind of preferment
exactly.
He should.
Arthur fails to reward Lanval as he merits. This is a significant failing. Largesse, that is generosity, was, as the trouvères and troubadours constantly reminded their patrons, an essential chivalric quality, and it was particularly important for kings and counts. But it's more complicated than Arthur simply being stingy. Marie tells us that Arthur, quote, shared out with a generous hand to all but one, end quote, and that one is Lanval. And Marie leaves little doubt that Lanval deserved a handsome reward. He's a king's son, and he served Arthur, according to Marie, with many a deed. Lanval is also generous, perhaps to a fault. He spent all the money that he brought with him to court in expectation that the king would give him even more. But in the words of the poet, quote, the king gave Lanval just what he asked for, end quote, and that is nothing. We are not told why, except by implication. The problem is that Lanval is a bit too good. As Marie writes, quote, for being brave and generous, for his beauty and his prowess, he was envied by all the court, by those who claimed to hold him dear, end quote. In the romances, as in real life, royal and baronial courts could be snake pits of intrigue and rumor mongering as courtiers and household knights competed with one another for a lord's or a lady's favor.
And so what you end up with is you have Lanval, who is this foreign knight who is chosen to serve Arthur, and Arthur neglects him. Arthur is allowing Lanval to go broke in giving all of his goods.
Because Lanval has to give away his stuff because it's what you do.
It is, and he's operating on the assumption that Arthur is going to repay him in kind to keep that gold cycle going.
It's the secular version of dot ou des.
Exactly. And it's not unlike the previous pre-conquest idea of kings as ring givers and
prince
and gold.
They're friends. Supposed to be.
Yes. And Arthur's not. And so Lanval ends up broke and he is kind of driven out. And it shows how superficial all the other knights are too, because Now they're not so interested in him.
Yeah, but Lampal is going to meet somebody who can help him.
Yes, he is. And he goes to a meadow, and he falls asleep on his saddle. That's all he's got left is his horse and his saddle.
Oh, that's so sad.
He's just destitute. And these beautiful women show up and say, well, you know, you think we're hot, but we serve somebody who's even more gorgeous than us. And she likes the look of you, and she would very much like you to be her paramour. She wants you to be her lover. There's no question that she wants him for sex. And amour, love, that might show up later. But Laval thinks about it for about a hot minute, and then he goes to meet this beautiful woman who's obviously a fairy woman. And she offers him everything. She offers him all the money he wants, all of the trappings of knighthood, as long as he doesn't tell anybody about her. And this is a common trope in Irish literature, too. It happens in the poem Bacchulina, where Macha shows up at the house of a poor man and says, well, I'm going to do everything you want as a wife and clean your house. You just can't tell anybody about me. And as invariably happens in the poem Bacchulina, this man ends up being challenged by King Conchobar, who has been boasting about his horses. And the farmer rather foolishly says, well, my wife, Macha, can defeat your horses at racing. And Conchobar, being Conchobar, who's not a nice guy, says, prove it, bring her here. Well, the fairy woman who has told her husband, don't talk about me, could just disappear. She doesn't. She shows up. She's 9 months pregnant. And she races the horses. And as she crosses the finish line, she goes into labor. And she goes into such labor, and she's in so much pain, and nobody will help her, that she curses all the men of Ulster to suffer birthing pains for 9 days. Anybody of a certain age and a certain lineage are going to be afflicted with these birthing pains. And she dies. And that, of course, is the entire precipitating fact of the poem, because the men of Ulster, because they're not knights, the men of Ulster can't defend against Connacht and Maeve's armies because they're all laid low with birth pangs, all because the man couldn't keep his mouth shut. In Lanval, it's a similar pact. The fairy woman says, don't talk about me. And Lanval's like, sure, no problem. He goes back to Arthur's court.
And he now has wealth.
Yes, he does. And now everybody's like, hey, Lanval, we missed you. Where have you been? And Lanval's not buying it, really, this time. And, of course, first among those people who start sucking up to him is Guinevere. And Guinevere goes to him. Guinevere expresses intense interest, intense interest. And she propositions him. And Lanval's response is, I'm sorry, no, you are the wife of my king. That would be bad form. It is really bad form to shag the wife of your king.
Right answer.
Right answer. She's not taking that answer. In fact, she gets really pissy about it. And she says to him, no, but wait. Well, you clearly just don't like women then. You must like men. And Lanval's like, no, really. It's not that. And she said, well, what is it then? And he said, well, I have a woman who's more beautiful than you.
Worse than that, Lanval tells Guinevere, not only is his woman more beautiful than you are, but, quote, her serving maids, even the poorest in her train, is better than you are, Lady Queen, in beauty of body and of face, in goodness and in well-bred grace.
Well, Guinevere is pissed. Guinevere's furious. And she says, well, that's not possible. And he said, but it is. And of course, now Lanval has violated his oath.
Not only has he violated his word, his pledge to his elfin lady, but he also is going to have to prove his claim. And that's because Guinevere, as you said, is really pissed. Marie writes, quote, the king had just come home from the wood. His day's hunting had been good. He went into the queen's chamber. She cried out loud when first she saw him, fell at his feet, begged mercy, accused Lanval. He had shamed her. He'd asked her for a love affair. She said no. With this result, he'd offer her an ugly insult. He boasted of a friend so fair, so full of pride, breeding honor, that the chambermaid, who waited on her, the lowliest, poorest of the poor, compared to the queen, was worth far more, end quote. Guinevere complains to Arthur that she is so sick from the insult that she will not rise from bed until Arthur avenges the shame and gives her justice according to the law.
Arthur allows it. Arthur insists that Lanval be imprisoned. He insists that there be a trial. And he insists that Lanval actually produce this woman or be executed. And the only knight who speaks up on Lanval's behalf is Gawain. And he tells Arthur, because Gawain is usually the voice of counsel, good counsel, he tells Arthur, no, this is wrong. You know that this is wrong. You know what Guinevere is like, but you know this is wrong. And ultimately, Arthur follows through. He listens to Guinevere. He takes her side. None of the other knights really want to be involved. But during the trial, the fairy lady arrives with dozens and dozens of beautiful women who precede her. And as each woman comes in, every one of them is more beautiful than the last. And by the time the fairy woman shows up, she's just stunning. She's the most gorgeous thing in the world.
Margot Robbie.
There you go. Or any one of the most beautiful women in Hollywood.
No, Margot Robbie.
All right, fine. But she's just stunning. And Guinevere is proven wrong, and Arthur and Guinevere are basically gobsmacked. They have nothing to say. And Lanval is so grateful that his fairy love has forgiven him and has saved his bacon and shown up. He gets on her horse, and she takes him off to fairyland, and they ride off literally into the sunset.
Live happily ever after.
They do. And that's Marie's take on this adultery. And it's possible that Lanval's a little bit of a precursor to Lancelot.
Maybe about the same time.
About the same time, because she's a contemporary with Chrétien.
And Chrétien pretty much invents
Lancelot, yes. Yeah. Because there's no other evidence for Lancelot preceding him.
So the first time we see Lancelot is in the poem The Knight of the Cart.
Yes, De Chevalier La Charrette. So The Knight of the Cart, Chrétien crafts this romance where he claims he got the subject matter from Eleanor of Aquitaine's daughter, Marie de Champagne.
And he didn't want to write it.
He says that. He says, I didn't want to write it. I'm under duress. The material is entirely down to the Countess. Not my fault. Don't blame me.
Yes.
If you have a problem with it, not my fault. Which is an interesting disclaimer. Chaucer does something similar with The Miller's Tale. He says, the miller's a churl. He's a drunkard. If you keep reading, it's your own fault. Don't blame me. Chrétien says something similar. And then he begins this story of Arthur's court that actually doesn't make Arthur look very good. Because what happens is Arthur and his court are at feast, which often is the setting for these stories. So many things happen at feast. And in comes a knight who very arrogantly challenges Arthur and says, I have hundreds of your dukes, duchesses, noble people in my prisons, you know, or I'm here from Maligant with that message. And Maligant has all these people in his prisons. And if you want them back, you have to send Guinevere out into the forest with one knight. And if that knight can meet my champion or meet me in single combat, then the queen is yours and all the people in my prisons. If that knight fails, I get Guinevere. In many ways, it's almost like a chess game. Because you want to protect your queen. And your queen is the most powerful. Your queen can move the most places.
I like that.
But as in a chess game, the queen also is meant to protect the king. And in this instance, the queen becomes this unbelievable pawn where she has no say in the matter. Arthur hears this challenge. And instead of thinking of the king and the kingdom and his role as king, what he does is he's pondering what to do, and Kay, his foster brother, the seneschal, who's always a bit of a dick.
Oh, a bit?
He's always a dick. Kay is useless, except at being a seneschal. He's really good at feasts and organizing the kingdom, but he wants to be a knight. He is a knight, but he wants to actually go in combat.
And he always gets defeated.
And he's always the worst one. And Kay is so determined to do this that he goes to Arthur and says, Arthur, I've had it. I'm no longer going to be your seneschal. He stamps his little foot and says, I'm leaving your service. And Arthur's like, what? Why? And he's like, nope, I refuse. I'm done.
And Arthur goes to Guinevere and says, Guinevere, offer him anything. Prostrate yourself in front of him if you have to. Now, that's a hell of a thing to ask the queen to do.
And is, why would you want to keep him?
Exactly. And Guinevere has misgivings, because in this...
Because Guinevere does know that Kay is a dick.
She does. She also knows that Kay is the least likely to actually succeed at this. So she is sent by Arthur. She kind of sighs and does what Arthur asks her. She goes to Kay and says, what can we do to keep you? And he's like, nope, not going to do it. She prostrates herself. She lays on the floor in front of him and says, tell us, what can we do? We promise you anything. And Kay thinks, anything? Mm-hmm. That's the open-ended promise you just don't do. You just don't do that. Somebody says, I promise I'll give you whatever you want. Don't do that. I tell my students, don't do that. Don't do that. It's never going to end well. And Kay says, okay, you have sworn this oath that you'll give me whatever I ask. And he goes to Arthur and says, I want to be the knight that takes Guinevere out into the forest. And you can just hear everybody go, fuck. Oh, no. And even Guinevere's horse, they bring a palfrey out to her and she whispers to the horse, if you knew what you were doing, you wouldn't take me anywhere from this court. You wouldn't move a foot. And the horse is kind of looking at her like, not my problem. And as soon as Kay leads her out, Gawain takes Arthur aside and in private, because Gawain, again, voice of good counsel, Gawain says to Arthur, uncle, you screwed up. That was a mistake. Because you know Kay's going to lose, right? And honestly, that was not a good thing to do. You just royally screwed that up. So I propose that we follow him and we go and see if we can't possibly still retrieve the queen and all of these people. Now, the important thing to keep in mind here is Maleagant has been able to capture untold numbers of Arthur's nobility without Arthur knowing it.
Yeah.
And when you have Arthurian texts where these things happen, it happens in the alliterative Mort d'Arthur, it happened in Geoffrey of Monmouth, the episode with the Giant of Mont Saint-Michel. If you've got somebody who is terrorizing your people for years, and you as king don't know, the question is why? Why don't you know? And what does that say about a king who, when he finds out, says, okay, I'm going to deal with it, as in the alliterative Mort d'Arthur, or I'm going to send somebody else to deal with it? Technically speaking, he should be involved in that process, but he has to also not put his life in undue risk. Well, in Chrétien, Kay is now going to go do this. They arrive at the meadow where the battle has taken place. Guinevere is gone. Kay is gone, but his horse is there covered in blood. Obviously, Kay lost.
Yeah.
And at this moment, out of nowhere, comes this knight on a horse, and he is riding that poor horse into the ground. And he's basically like, which way did they go? And we have no idea who he is. We have no idea how he knew what was going on. We have no idea where he came from. But he is pursuing the queen. And eventually what happens is everybody finds out that he is Lancelot du Lac. He is the knight who is in pursuit of the queen. We know nothing else about him. He's going to take the more perilous road. There are all of these options for getting there. And Arthur and his knights are like, well, we'll all go and try and get her back. Gawain takes the bridge that's the underwater bridge and gets trapped and practically drowns. Lancelot takes the sword bridge, which you can envision this narrow blade, and he has to walk across and he cuts himself to ribbons in the process. A lot of bloodshed without anybody actually dying. There's a lot of blood in this text. And eventually, when Lancelot's horse dies, he needs another horse, and he's got to get to Guinevere. And along comes a dwarf with a cart.
Thank God for dwarves.
Always in medieval literature. Though, of course, dwarves often
can be
a little iffy in terms of their loyalties or their presence. Unless
they're played by Peter Dinklage.
Exactly. Which is, I mean, he's always the good guy.
He's always.
Always the good guy. But in this instance, the dwarf is more like an agent of fate, because he shows up on this cart and he says to Lancelot, I'll take it, but you got to get in the back. You can't ride up front
with
me.
Which is shameful.
Absolutely. Because only criminals are transported in carts. And this is specifically the kind of cart that a criminal would be transferred to a stockade, to a pillory, or to the gallows. And so Lancelot thinks about it for just a little tiny second, like a hot second. He thinks about it. He hesitates for 2 seconds. And then he gets in the cart because he realizes that his reputation as a knight, even though it is on the line here, because that is what is on the line,
yes,
he is willing to put that aside for Guinevere.
Yeah,
she doesn't deserve it, because when he does get to Maleganz Castle and all of the things that ensue, and he goes to her, she basically puts her hand, talk to the hand. She don't want to talk to him. And he's like, what did I do? She's like, you hesitated for 2 steps. And his thought is, but I have sacrificed my entire knightly reputation to save you. And she's like, no, you're going to have to make it up to me. And there are all of these various contests and jousts and tournaments, and people are in disguise, people are not in disguise. And that sets the bar for the rest of the Arthurian cycle. In this text, though, it's very clear that somehow Lancelot and Guinevere have established this relationship.
Yes.
We don't know how, we don't know when, and we don't know for how long.
But we are going to learn that, not from Cruzian.
No.
From a generation after Cruzian and 2 generations after Cruzian.
Absolutely, because this trope of Lancelot and Guinevere becomes very popular. Now, in Cruzian, there is absolutely no question whatsoever that they are having sex. There is no doubt at all. In fact, after all of the various battles, Guinevere is in a room asleep with Kay and the other knights who have been wounded in trying to save her. And Kay is, in fact, unconscious, bloodied, lying at the foot of her bed when Lancelot, so desperate to get to the queen, pulls the bars of the window asunder and practically severs his finger, because it says it cuts it down to the bone. And he manages to get to the window. He's bleeding profusely. He goes to the queen's bed. They spend all night in bed together. They are clearly having sex. Chrétien is explicit. And then he sneaks out. And the next morning, Maleganz, who is fairly certain that the queen is up to adultery, comes in the morning, pulls the bed curtains aside. The bed is covered in blood. And how Guinevere didn't notice this is, well, I guess he was good. She's in a bit of a haze. Lucky girl. And Maleganz says, you committed adultery. Where is the knight who was bleeding? You were clearly having sex with one of the men in the room. And she says, I had a nosebleed. And Maleganz's like, really? No, not at all. And she says, I swear that I did not have sex with any of the knights currently in the room. It's a very carefully worded answer.
It is.
Because it's technically correct. And thus, when she's put on trial for that adultery, and she needs a champion to come save her, you end up with this trial by combat where the victor is presumed to be innocent because they win. But what we see in so many of these cases, because Guinevere will be on trial for lots of things in a lot of texts, sometimes murder, sometimes adultery. She doesn't commit murder, but she does commit the adultery. You have to have that wiggle room for the presumption of innocence. But it's really just that Lancelot's such a good knight that he's going to kick everybody's ass anyway.
Yeah, but you, for the audience, you really can't have a trial by combat in which the guilty party wins.
Yeah.
Therefore, you have to have the technicality that allows you to get off. What's interesting about this is, and the protest that Chrétien makes, that this is not my poem. This is really, I'm using my talent to write you a poem that you gave me to write.
Right.
Is that for most of his romances, it's marital love.
It is.
It's not adulterous passion, but it's marital love that he's extolling.
Yes.
That's what Yvain is about. And the one poem which is his, in which you do have adulterous love that is presented favorably, it's a complicated matter because you have Cligès.
Yes.
And in the poem Cligès, which is a really rambling poem,
and it's
has 2 parts to it. But when we finally get to Cligès, Cligès is going to fall in love with Finis, and Finis is going to be married to his uncle.
Right. His very Tristan and Isolde kind of plot.
Very much. His uncle is the emperor of the Greeks. And Finis is the daughter of the emperor of the Germans. The problem is that Kleges is actually the legitimate heir to the throne.
Right.
Because his father was the older of the two brothers, and his uncle Alice had taken the throne, but promised that he would never marry.
Right, and then he does.
And he does. So he breaks the promise, which casts doubt upon the legitimacy of the marriage, and also provides perhaps an excuse for the love that grows between Venice and Kleges, since Kleges should be king of the Greeks and should be marrying the daughter of the king of the Germans.
And it's also the sense that Venice is drawn to Kleges because of his honor and nobility, and at least
and Kleges really does try.
He
goes off to King Arthur's court so that he would be removed from this
temptation. Yes.
And it's Venice who, more than Kleges, who wants to be together forever.
Right.
And so what she does is she concocts this weird plot. She's going to fake her death with the type of potion that always seems to be available in stories like this.
Yes.
She was going to appear to be dead. They're going to cut her off and she can run away with Kleges.
However,
there are three physicians.
From Salerno.
Yes. And they realize that this is not really, she's not really dead. They revive her, and then they torture her.
Well, they actually torture her before they revive her. They're trying to get her to cop. They think
for a plot.
Exactly. And so when they start applying torture, and as physicians, particularly in the 12th century, for physicians to apply torture, when torture isn't even part of accepted canon
law. You know, I kept on forgetting, you are the torture lady. You are my go-to for everything medieval perverse.
And this is perverse because what happens is these physicians from Salerno, what they do to her while she's catatonic, she actually cannot respond. Even if she wanted to cop to it, even if she wanted to confess, she can't because she's still under the influence of the medication that she's taken. And they do horrible things to her. And those physicians are violating their oaths as physicians, but they're also violating the law. Because torture is not an acceptable part of canon law at this time.
Exactly.
That doesn't come in until 1215 with Fourth Lateran Council. And torture as an instrument of less majesty, the right of the king, isn't even fully established in the 12th century. So Chrétien's answer to that is, as these physicians from Salerno are torturing her, 1,000 ladies come into the room and defenestrate the physicians. They throw them out the window to their deaths.
Defenestrate them for Venice.
Yes.
Okay.
They defenestrate them for Venice. And Chrétien goes into graphic detail about how these physicians' bodies are broken when they are thrown out the window when they finally hit the courtyard.
I don't think Chrétien liked physicians.
Oh, I don't think he liked the torture.
The literary scholar Deborah Nelson made a very interesting argument that the torture suffered by Venice would have been understood by the audience as the penance required to absolve her of the sin of adultery. After all, she suffers this because she was plotting to continue her adultery. Kleges is okay because Kleges is really resisting.
Yes.
Venice is really trying to figure out, how do I make this work?
Right.
And so what you give her is penance.
Yes.
She can she's going to achieve absolution through her suffering. And fortunately for everybody, as Kleges goes off for some reason to King Arthur again to get his support to overthrow his uncle. Who's a usurper. His uncle conveniently dies.
Right. And removes that obstacle altogether.
And so Kleges and Venice now can get married.
Yes.
And they now have good marital sex. And
That's okay. Yeah, and what's interesting is, of course, a lot of modern assumptions about medieval sex and medieval sexuality and medieval adultery are very modern. They're not medieval. In the Middle Ages, sex happened, people committed adultery, and unless you were in a position where the paternity of your offspring was an issue, as with royalty or aristocratic lineage, in a lot of cases, nobody cared.
I'm going to push back a little on that. You're absolutely right that sex was not a taboo subject in the Middle Ages. medieval literature is anything but prudish. As your own work on medieval Fablio shows, these humorous short stories were filled with sex. The cuckolding of pompous, unaware husbands was a favorite subject. Adultery was a subject exploited for its potential humor. But this doesn't mean that adultery wasn't taken seriously. Giovanni Malatesta took it so seriously that he killed his wife and his younger brother when he caught them in the act. And Thomas Aquinas' observation that secular courts often overlooked the murder of adulterous wives suggests that Giovanni was not unique. The High and Late Middle Ages was an era of honor and shame, and even the rumor of a wife's infidelity threatened a husband's public reputation, his honor. Perhaps the most shocking case of adultery among the upper ranks of medieval society is the affair of the Tower of Nesle. In 1314, the wives of King Philip IV of France's three sons were arrested on charges of adultery. Two of them, Blanche and Margaret, were said to have engaged in sexual affairs with two Norman knights, the brothers Gautier and Philip of Aunay. The third, Joan, was accused of having known about these illicit activities but concealed them. The Norman knights confessed after being tortured. Philip's judges were notorious for using torture, most notably in the suppression of the Templars, and Blanche and Margaret were tried and convicted by the Parlement of Paris. They were publicly paraded with shaved heads and then sentenced to life imprisonment. Joan was eventually acquitted. The two knights fared less well. They were convicted of treason. They were castrated, flayed alive, broken on the wheel, and finally hanged. This was an especially serious case of adultery because it involved royalty. Alexandre Dumas used it as the subject for a melodrama that he wrote in 1832. Certainly the church, at least officially, took both adultery and fornication seriously. Marriage is a sacrament.
Yes.
And in 1215, it's listed as one of the sacraments. So at that point, any problem with marriage is going to be a problem to be heard in a canon law court. And in the case of the church, adultery was a genderless sin. It was equally sinful for a wife or a husband to commit adultery. Thomas Aquinas wrote that adultery by either sex is to be punished in the same way. Priests saw adultery as a sin that needed to be expiated through penance, or else it would not be forgiven. And the problem was that very few women, apparently, were willing to bring accusations of adultery against their husbands. Certainly not as many as husbands who were willing to accuse their wives. This concerned Aquinas. Quote, "The Christian religion condemns adultery by either sex equally, yet women do not lightly accuse their husbands of adultery or take revenge by exposing the sin. In contrast, men freely take counsel with priests about putting away adulterous wives. Thus, women are deprived of communion and their crimes are exposed, but men cannot be deprived of communion because what they have done lies hidden. From now on, both will be charged if a crime is detected. Thus, by treating the matter in the same way, motives for revenge will be removed because accusations will cease." The records of English ecclesiastical courts in the 14th century are filled with cases of adultery and even fornication. To give you a sense of how these ecclesiastical courts operated and the sentences they imposed, I'll read the court record for a case brought before the Lincoln Dean and Chapter in the year 1347. John Maribel, a married man, is cited of adultery and incest with Alice, daughter of Robert D. Wewell, daughter of the said John's wife. The man appears and admits his sin. The woman is not found, and John is forbidden from coition from sex with either the mother or the daughter in future, unless the mother, who is the wife, seeks the marital debt and he pays it with sadness. And I love that. He has to not enjoy it. and he will have as penance to make a pilgrimage with bare feet to St. Mary at Lincoln, to St. Thomas at Canterbury, and to St. Thomas Cantaloupe at Hereford, and to beatings in penitential fashion round the church and round the marketplace of Grantham. It is later held that the same John on his pilgrimage would take much from his said wife, so the penance was changed, so that he will fast on bread and water as long as he lives every fourth and sixth week, unless work or sickness prevents this. I love the practicality of this. We, John, warn thee, the aforesaid John, once, twice, and a third time, that you, having been parted for good from your wife, will eject the same Alice, who apparently showed up again, from your company within the next 6 days under pain of greater excommunication, which is now pronounced most firmly on your person in these writings, if you should disdain to carry out the aforegoing. There are many, many records of cases like this, although few are probably as lurid as this one is. Some of the clergy who sat in judgment were also guilty of the sexual offenses for which they assigned penance. That's clear from the Fablio, which are filled with stories about licentious clerics. But I agree with your larger point completely. We can't, we shouldn't, impose our own ideas about sexuality, our categories about sexual identity on medieval people. It just doesn't work.
Right. And you get this contradiction in the literary sources because, yes, they're having sex. Lancelot and Guinevere, we know they have sex in Chrétien de Troyes. Well, later authors have to try and find a way to exonerate them and say, well, maybe not. It's possible that they didn't. And this is what happens with the story of Lancelot and Guinevere.
So tell about that. How is the story transformed? How do we get the story that we know from T.H.Y., from
First Night, those awful movies of 1990s.
Yeah. How do we get that story?
We get that story from first Chrétien, who is very clear that they're having sex. And I would actually argue that Chrétien is not celebrating it. I would actually argue that Chrétien is not necessarily celebrating that adultery because of the problems it causes for Arthur. But Chrétien doesn't do anything further with it. That's, you get the knight of the cart.
Lancelot's not heard from again.
Not in Chrétien. And it's the French tradition of the Vulgate cycle, the whole Lancelot cycle.
Why is it called the Vulgate?
Well, because it's in French.
It's a vulgar language.
It's in the actual vernacular tongue. And so it's called the Vulgate cycle. And it's a series of stories that really take the French guy and their texts in French and elevates Lancelot to this unbelievable status. The problem is that it's at the expense of Arthur, and it's at the expense of Gawain. And Lancelot's adulterous relationship with Guinevere is still problematic, but it now starts to add layers of, oh, but it's love. Oh, but they're madly in love with each other. Oh, but they're really, 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 really in love with each other, as though that's going to make it okay. The French texts are less concerned about the adultery. They are more concerned.
Because they're French.
Well, that's possible. Again, we have the entire genre of Fablio, which is contemporary.
Yeah.
So, the Lancelot cycle is contemporary with the Fablio. And you see that these contesting issues of adultery and sex, explicit sex, which always shocks my students who assume that nobody in the Middle Ages ever had sex. I'm like, of course they did.
They wouldn't have had the Renaissance.
Exactly. The texts, the Fablio, it's not love. In the Fablio, they are fucking each other. The text is explicit. The body parts bang against each other. You are fucking, and they say that. In the romances, they dress it up a little bit, and then they add the love aspect. But they're really not concerned too much with the adultery. Now, there's a whole German tradition that is very concerned with the adulterous aspects and proving women. You have the court mantel, which is also French, where you have all these adulterous women who, if they wear this magic scarf, it grows longer depending on how adulterous or how pure they are. If you're pure, it's long. If you're adulterous, it's short. And for some of the women of the court, it's really short. It's like not even a scarf. It's like a handkerchief. So you do have this concern with noble women's sexuality, and that's tied to primogeniture. That's tied to laws of inheritance and the developing system of bloodline inheritance.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what the problem with cuckoldry is. And
yes.
And I think it's telling that in the Lancelot story with Guinevere and in the, we'll talk a little bit about Tristan and Isolde, that these women don't have children.
Yes.
And therefore, there isn't the problem of paternity for the children.
Right.
Once you have a possibility that this is not
Arthur's child,
it goes from merely being titillating to being horribly shameful to Arthur.
Yes. And in fact, it's shameful to Arthur all along. And this is what happens to Arthur's characters. He gets kind of divided depending on the versions of the story between either a willing cuckold who knows and just doesn't want to talk about it because really, you know, the least said soonest mended and we don't need to make it public, but other people make it public and force his hand, or he's just blind to it, which means that as a king, he's not aware of what's even going on in his own bedchamber, which goes back to my point about the things that happen in his kingdom that he doesn't know about.
And here's one of the interesting things about shame. Shame has to be public.
Yes.
If everything is private, nobody knows what's going on.
Yes.
It's not shameful. It may be wrong. It may be immoral, but it's not shameful.
Because their reputation, if the publica fama is the reputation of legal standing.
Exactly. So we have a situation with William Marshall, and it's a great story that is in the L'Histoire de Guillaume Le Maréchal, written by this poet, John, based upon the recollections of William Marshall's household, especially John of Early, his squire. And one of the stories is about the accusation made against William Marshall. Marshall was the leading household knight in the court of the young King Henry.
Right.
A king who was anointed by his father, Henry II, but given no land to rule. And nope. Just simply is basically a
king in training.
Supposedly. A king in training.
Yes.
Wandering about with his household, going from tournament to tournament because he doesn't have much of anything else to do besides tournaments.
Right. And his mother actually pushes to have him given responsibility.
Ability. And so Marshall, who was a landless knight, the youngest son of a local English baron, became young King Henry's master at arms. Best tournament knight he has, so good that the young Henry makes him a banneret. It allows him to have a banner and to have his own contingent of knights in tournaments. Marshall is the real-life counterpart to Lanvell. Just as Lanvell's superior qualities inspired the envy, the jealousy of the other knights of King Arthur's household, William Marshall's qualities and the love that was shown to him by young King Henry inspired envy and jealousy by his fellow household knights, many of whom were of higher status than he was.
Right.
There's a term that's used in the lit of the time, losangie. These are the bitter and sarcastic and envious older household knights
right.
who are always gossiping.
Right.
False gossip about the younger knights who are excelling above them.
Right.
These losangiers start a whispering campaign against Marshall. They accuse him of having shown disrespect for the young king, a charge of lèse majesté, by carrying his banner at tournaments in front of the young king's banner. Much more seriously, however, is another rumor, one that is being whispered, but whispered loudly. It's that Marshall is having sex with the young king's wife, Margaret.
Right.
Yeah, daughter of the king of France. Pretty. Well. And it's a Lancelot. It's a Lancelot and Guinevere.
It is.
And Marshall is outraged.
Right. Because he wouldn't dream of it.
Because he wouldn't dream of it. But here's the problem. He wants to acquit himself of this. Young Henry doesn't want to allow him. Because if they have a public trial by combat,
Marshall loses,
then young Henry is shamed.
Right.
It is much better to bury the whole thing, banish Marshall from his court, and not permit this to be aired as a public.
Right.
As long as it's a rumor
right.
that can be denied, it's fine.
Right. And this is what happens with the Arthurian tradition. Because in so many cases, Arthur knows, but he doesn't want it discussed. And when you get to the later texts, like the late 14th century, Stanzaic Mort d'Arthur, you have this whole contest of justice because the king has got to be the arbiter of justice. He can't defend his wife even if he wanted to because he's got to be their judge.
Yes.
And you have to have a champion who's willing to fight for them. And in the Stanzaic Mort d'Arthur, which is a Middle English version of the Voix Mort d'Arthur, so one of the French texts, in that text, Guinevere is actually accused of murder. In that text, she is aware that there are rumors circulating about her and Lancelot. So Lancelot leaves court and she decides to hold a feast to celebrate all of the knights so that she's not showing preferment. And this is deliberately meant to kind of squelch the rumors about her and Lancelot. And at that feast, somebody's trying to kill Gawain. And so they poison an apple because they know that Gawain likes apples.
This is always happening.
Absolutely.
And it always goes astray.
It does, because somebody else eats the apple. And in this case, it's a poor feckless Irish knight. And he eats the apple, Patrick, and he drops dead right then and there. And the assumption is that Guinevere has murdered him because she offers him the apple. She doesn't know it's poisoned because in this instance, she's not guilty of murder. Not guilty of murder. And all the other knights are convinced that she's done it. They don't actually think very well of her, which is part of that reputation.
Yes.
Because she has a reputation among the knights that is already dishonorable. And because of that, when Arthur says, well, we got to put you on trial because I have to act as judge. That's the law. You have a murdered knight whose brother has come publicly demanding a trial of the queen. Arthur might have dealt with it himself, but since the brother is there, he insists. Guinevere has to find somebody to fight for her. Now, as I said, Lancelot had made himself absent because of the rumors. And she goes to all of the knights and asks, can you defend me? And they all say no. They refuse. And not all of them refuse nicely. Some of them are actually really nasty and salty about it. Until finally, Sir Bors says, all right, fine. I'll do it. And what ultimately happens is actually Lancelot shows up and he defeats Sir Mador and she is found innocent of murder. After that, though, the rumors keep going about her and Lancelot and he goes to her chamber and the text is clear that they have sex, that they spend the night together. And at which point, Agravain and Mordred, who are brothers, lead 12 knights to the room and catch them at it. What happens in the Stanzaic, though, is that it's clear they're having sex. And now there's going to have to be another trial. And now we have the complex issues that she's actually guilty of this.
Yeah.
And she's guilty of not only having committed adultery, but it's treason. And so then the text gets bound up in the fact that she is rescued by Lancelot, who goes and kills everybody who's guarding her at the stake, including Gawain's two youngest brothers.
Which is the problem.
And as soon as, because Gawain is again telling Arthur, enough, stop this
nonsense.
Until
his brothers are, especially Gareth.
Yes, when Gareth and Gaheris.
Because he's good.
They're both good, and they're young, and they're unarmed, and they are there because Gawain won't. Gawain refuses to participate in any of this. And Gareth and Gaheris go. Lancelot just comes in and slaughters everybody because it's his idiom, as Monty Python would say.
Yeah.
And he rescues her and takes her off to the Joyous Garde. Gawain now wants revenge for his brothers, and he's justified. It's a valid complaint.
Yes.
And he propels Arthur into action. And essentially,
it's also Arthur's kin.
It is. And this is the other problem, is that Arthur, in not wanting to do anything about it, is actually harming his own reputation. Lancelot keeps swearing that he and Guinevere are innocent. We know they're not. And he's lying to Arthur every chance he gets. No, we didn't. We know that they did. And that's the conflict in this text. And it's while Arthur is trying to get Guinevere back that Mordred, who's been left in control of the kingdom, takes it. And so then Arthur has to come back. And Gawain has fought Lancelot repeatedly and been wounded in the head. He's received head wounds. And he's not had time to recover from them. And when he has to go with Arthur to take his throne back, he gets hit in the head as they do as part of the landing party, and he dies right then. And of course, Arthur has this massive lament for the death of Gawain. But ultimately what happens is the treason of Mordred overthrows that treason of Lancelot and Guinevere. And so that's never dealt with. Mallory in 1471 in the Mort d'Arthur tries to clean it up. He tries to exonerate the two of them because Mallory himself, a traitor, because he's in prison.
And a rapist.
He is, if it's the Thomas Mallory we think it is, what it probably is, he's a rapist. He is just a nasty piece of work. The legal records of Sir Thomas Mallory are not nice.
Not nice.
But he's caught up in the Wars of the Roses. And he switches sides. And he goes from supporting Edward IV to supporting the House of Lancaster. And he gets caught by Edward IV. And ultimately, the Mort d'Arthur is this argument of loyalty, where I may have been loyal to the wrong person, but at least I was loyal.
Yes.
And Lancelot, for him, is that epitome of loyalty. And so in that exact episode, which is translated from the same French text, and Mallory may have known the Middle English version, the Stanzaic, you end up having this wiggle room where when Agravaine and Mordred show up, and in the Stanzaic, they show up with a jury of 12 men to judge. And it's essentially, that's how you catch people in adultery. You have to catch them at it.
Yes, you do.
By law, you have to. The 13th century custom d'argent in France is very clear.
It's too easy to make the accusation.
Absolutely.
You need to have evidence.
And the evidence in the custom d'argent is that you have to show up, husband has to show up, catch the wife in flagrante delicto with two judges. He's got to have two judges with him. And he has to take the two judges, catch his wife having sex with the other fella. And if they can catch the other guy, then the wife and the lover are bound naked back to back. And they are forced to walk through the streets of the town in full view of everybody with people banging drums, trumpets. Yeah. Basically, Game of Thrones season 5. Walk of shame. Shame. And that's their punishment. There is no actual further physical punishment. There's no castration. There's no other form of torture. It's that, because you catch them at it. You don't need a confession. Your proof is there. They're punished. And then we're done. The problem is that taint of that reputation, the publica fama, has now been destroyed. And so anytime wife or lover end up in court, they have no standing, or their standing is diminished significantly. And so now anybody can bring court cases against them because of that adultery.
Yes.
So for Mallory, he wants to avoid that. He is trying to avoid the tarnishing of that public reputation. And so when he has Lancelot go to Guinevere, clad only in his mantle, and so he's basically wearing maybe his tunic and maybe we don't know. It just says he's wearing his mantle. For all we know, he may be naked under that because he's carrying his sword under his arm, which says to me that he is not wearing pants because he's not wearing a sword belt. He goes with his sword under his arm, dressed in his mantle, to Guinevere, and Mallory says, whether they were at bed at other disports, we don't know. We list not to say. As the French book saith, they were together, but love back then is not like love is nowadays. And he does this weird thing where he basically tries to say, well, the French book says they were together, but we don't know that they're having sex. And if you've read the French book, we do know they're having sex, because the French book is explicit. They're having sex.
But what's neat is that because Mallory wants to make Lancelot into this true hero, even giving him a glimpse of the Grail.
Oh, just a glimpse, but just a glimpse. The sun, yes.
But he does get a glimpse of it.
Yes.
Is that it also rehabilitates the reputation of Guinevere.
Yes.
Because in order for her to be an appropriate object for his true love,
she has to be
a true lover.
And she is only faithful to to Lancelot in that sense, because despite all the other texts where she's not, like all of the variations from Geoffrey of Monmouth, where it's Mordred she's shagging, and Lanval, where it's anybody. And in fact, the 15th century Sir Launfal, which is an adaptation of Marie de France's Lanval, Thomas Chester's Sir Launfal, Guinevere's shagging everybody, and everybody knows it.
But not for Mallory.
And, I mean, the punishment of Guinevere and Sir Launfal is hilarious, because when the fairy woman shows up, she blows in Guinevere's face and blinds her. And in that text, nobody wants to take her up on the trial by combat either, because they all know that she's shagging everybody.
She's guilty.
Mallory, who's a contemporary of Thomas Chester's, has to exonerate her too. And part of making her that pure object of love means that she has to only love Lancelot. But he wants there to be plausible deniability about the sexual aspect. And because Mallory's text is printed by William Caxton in 1485, Mallory's text is the last big medieval Arthurian romance in English, but it's the basis for everybody else's interpretation.
You know, I think we've run out of time. And I think we're going to come back and we'll talk about Tristan in the next episode.
Okay.
And we'll talk about movies.
Absolutely.
Medieval movies that have to do with this.
Absolutely, there are so many of them.
And we will talk about how both Tristan and Lancelot and Guinevere have made it into the movies.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Thank you so much, Richard. It's been a pleasure.
It's great having you as a co-host.
Thank you so much.
And bye for now.
Bye.